Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Bootstrap Web. Mr. Brian Castle, how are you, my friend?
Yes, yes. Jordan, how's it going, buddy?
It's good, man. It was great to see you at MicroConf. I found this year's conference fantastic. I'm sure we can get into it, but how you been?
Yeah, doing good. Definitely getting back into the swing of things after, I guess it's been almost a full week since MicroConf, and took a few slow days there, but definitely getting back into it and making good progress. So yeah, always a good time out there in Vegas. I definitely expect to continue coming back year after year. It's always good.
Absolutely. Yeah, I went straight from Vegas to Vancouver, British Columbia, and with the fam for spring break, and it was that city's phenomenal, man.
Oh, that's cool. That's always been on the list for me. I always wanted to head out there. Haven't been.
Yeah, we had not been either. It was a beautiful city. Very different from Vegas.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have a bunch of updates and stuff to talk about, but why don't we dig into our MicroConf experience a little bit before we, you know, head away from it.
While I was there sitting in the talks, I did jot down just a couple of notes from just a few of the speakers that really, you know, just they said something so interesting that it caused me to pull out my phone and, oh, I got to write that down. I could talk about a few of those, but maybe before we do, like, I had this conversation with Ben Orenstein yesterday. I was on his podcast. I've heard this from a few different people in our MicroConf crew that we hang out with, that like, it seems different now. Like, I don't know if it's like the talks are different or our perception of the talks are different at this stage, or maybe at Growth Edition, having the format of the talks the way they are isn't quite ideal. Like, I don't know, how do you feel about it? Like, did you sit in on all the talks?
I sat on almost all the talks. I think I missed about half of one session of the attendee talks, but I got a lot out of the talks. The previous 2 years, I was really there to hang out with people and talk shop. And this year I was more hungry for content because of all like the new challenges in terms of management and team stuff and financing and all that. So I really paid attention, and the first two talks put me on like an emotional roller coaster. it was a trip, right? So it was Chris from Wistia, who talked about their experience raising money and then effectively changing their minds and going into debt, borrowing $17 million to pay off their investors. That felt very much like a cautionary tale, you know, perfectly fitting for MicroConf. And then the next talk was Rob interviewing Jason Fried. So you had like a VC-backed company that had, relatively speaking, a bad experience with it.
It was funny to see those back-to-back.
Right. And then you had like, you know, the fantasy ideal of bootstrapping in Basecamp. And I'm sitting in the audience, and, you know, we've been considering all of our financing options. We've been talking to everybody, angels, VCs, debt. We've been, you know, just exploring all of our financing options. And those two talks really like rekindled the bootstrap ethos, like in my belly. It's a trip because you're at a talk, you're in an audience, so you're just in your own head, just looking up at the stage. You're not talking to anyone for like 30 minutes at a time. And you kind of have to wrestle with all your thoughts.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I've always been a person who I just like to sit there and kind of take it in and then see which little nuggets sort of stick with me later. I'm not one of these people who like, you know, takes crazy notes every minute of every talk. I don't do that at all. I don't bring my computer or anything like that. I just like to sort of like take it in and see what sticks. I was excited to see Chris from Wistia. I'd never seen him speak before or hear anything behind the scenes from Wistia. Just kind of been a fan of the company for several years. So that was interesting. And then Jason Fried also I haven't seen live before, and that was always good. One note that I did jot down watching Jason talk was he used this term TikTok. I think he said like TikTok development, which I loved. Like, that resonated with me so much because I feel like that really described the way that I've been approaching my work over the last 5 or 6 plus years.
Yeah. Can you define it a bit more for people listening that weren't there?
Yeah. Well, what he was describing was, and this is an approach, I guess, that they sort of take at Basecamp, which is work on one product for a little while and then like launch it, you know, get it out there and let it do what it's going to do and then move away. Like let it sit, let it breathe, and then go work on another thing for 6 to 12 months, you know, and then maybe come back to that thing, that first thing, and give that a little bit more love for a few months, and then come back to something else. And I like that how he put it with like TikTok, because it's not like, it's not the same as like shiny object syndrome, where you're just bouncing from one thing to another thing to another thing to another thing, and it's and nothing is being productive. It's, you're still being strategic about what you're choosing to invest time and resources in, but you don't feel this pressure to choose one thing and have tunnel vision and don't ever think about doing anything else at all. And he was talking about kind of the benefits of stepping away and doing something else, getting refreshed, finding new ideas, getting energized about something new, and then taking that fresh energy back to the main thing. Like for them, you know, the Basecamp is their main thing, and then they sort of, you know, sidetrack every now and then with things like HiRise and other products over the years for them. I mean, like with me, like that's exactly how I've approached stuff. Like I've worked most of the past few years working on audience ops, but then 1 or 2 months out of a year, I'll pause and I'll work on my productized course and then let that sit for another year and do what it's going to do. And then, you know, come back and improve it a year later. Or like, you know, Sunrise KPI was one of those like temporary projects, build it, get it launched, then step away, don't touch it for a while. And I don't know, maybe I'll come back to it at some point, but for right now, I'm focused on Process Kit. So, you know, I just like that idea of TikTok.
What I got out of that talk and what I get out of Jason Fried's thinking and writing overall is he makes it more okay to be contrarian, right? Because he's a contrarian thinker. That's part of why those ideas seem fresh, because it's not what everyone else is doing and saying. And he kind of makes it okay to not do what everyone else tells you you should be doing. It kind of gives you, I know it gives me like a little bit more confidence to be like, well, I just don't want to do it that way. And so we're just not going to do it that way, even though everyone tells you you're supposed to. So the same way about like, well, you got to focus to really get, you know, real progress on something. And they just don't do it that way. It's like, no, we'll just leave it alone for 2 months. And then when we come back, there are benefits to doing that. Everyone stays fresh and excited. And then you come back to a project from a new perspective. And it's like, yeah, okay, cool. I don't think of it that way, but if that's what you guys want to do, I think about certain things in ways that most people think is not a best practice. And sometimes they feel guilty about it. And just listening to the way they do things and the way they think through things, it just gives you a little bit more confidence to be like, hey, you actually, there's no rule, there's no law on how to do stuff. So if you want to do things a certain way, you should feel free to do so.
So what were the other like couple of speakers who stuck out to you?
I'd say the big thing I got from Jason Fried that was tactical was, so he came off as, I guess, more humble than usual, right? He can be a little bombastic, and that's part of the appeal, but he came off more subdued. And one of the things he talked about was a lot of the mistakes that they've made and how they've learned over time to position things as experiments. So instead of we're going to do profit sharing and that's now a law and that, you know, is set in stone in the company forever, they position as we're going to try profit sharing for 3 years and then we'll reassess. He talked about something specific that sounded great, like, hey, let's get ideas from everybody. And then everyone can present what they might work on as like, what would you do if you had like 30 days to go off and work on something else? And how that sounds like a great idea. But in reality, what happened was most people got disappointed because they didn't get a chance to work on their project. And so a lot of those things that are like well-meaning that turn into mistakes, and then using the concept of experimentation and just positioning things to the company and the employees as this is an experiment. We don't know if this is the right thing. So it gives you an out. Without looking like a bad manager that you're going back and forth, or that you're like a bad guy that like gave something and then took it away. So that I took.
Very cool. The ones that I really enjoyed listening to were Sahil from Gumroad. Just, you know, very inspiring, interesting, unusual story there. I thought Patrick Campbell really had a pretty impactful talk. I was looking forward to his talk, you know, because I'm thinking a lot about pricing, and I thought I'd get some interesting info there, and it was not really about pricing at all. That made the most impact for me, just hearing him talk. Joanna Wiebe, I've seen her speak a few times, and they're always really good. This one I really liked because I think this was probably the most simple and actionable talk at MicroConf. She was talking about specific money words that you can use in your copy. I'm not going to get into all of it, but like I literally wrote those words down, and because, you know, I'm writing copy for marketing sites. That's what I do for my product. So these are literally things that I should go fix or improve in my copywriting. And then Patrick McKenzie, he was not supposed to be a speaker. Somebody else canceled and he stepped in last minute. Literally, like, I think of him more like a stand-up comedian. I'm not taking away from his very, very smart, insightful ideas on business. That it's that too. But like, I really feel like he should have like a Netflix special. You know, like,
yes. I mean, his timing and use of specific words and specific ways, everything comes with humor. The message is very valuable, but it comes with a lot of humor, which is fun.
Yeah, and it's so unique, like the, you know, just his delivery and everything. Like, I'm telling you, like he's like a, he needs a Netflix special. I'm all for it. I would watch it.
Yes, yes.
And Netflix would probably buy it too.
Yeah. They're into that sort of thing right now. Yeah. And I went out to dinner with him later that night. So got to like ask him a bunch of stuff about it and kind of just, you know, be a very happy audience for him and yeah, laugh my way through dinner.
Yeah. I will say just real quick that like, but I felt like the rest of the talks, like, you know, they had some good parts to them, but didn't really hit it for me. And I think I've heard that from a few other people. I mean, Rob's talk was very good as well. I always like hearing the update from Rob. But like, you know, some of the other ones, I don't know. Like I was talking to some friends of ours and it just seems like I think that they probably were very good talks and good speakers, good topics. But maybe my perception of them right now is not – it's just not as relevant to me. And I really appreciate the hallway time and like the Monday night where it's just open and you can do whatever. And, you know, a group of us did a bunch of stuff. We did some gambling and I think that's a big part of the value now of going back to MicroConf. The talks are a very small, insignificant part of being there, you know?
Yeah, they're part of it. And there's no way, I don't know if it's 8 talks or so total, but there's no way they're all going to be relevant. I think the key is, you know, if 2 or 3 are very relevant, then the content becomes very valuable. And like you said, a lot of it is just taking it in and kind of see what you know, it's in there now. It's rattling around your brain and it comes out at certain times and it becomes more relevant based on what you happen to be focusing on.
Yeah. And like idea, I wrote this in the survey after MicroConf. You know, like I really like the session with Jason or whoever it is each year that Rob interviews. Like I like that format where Rob is doing like the onstage interview. I think it could be cool. Maybe they've done this a few times now where if you have like a panel up there, just get like 3 people from the community and bring what's sort of like a hallway conversation, bring that on stage for whatever's happening this year, whatever's being talked about and, you know, audience questions, panel bats it around. Like I think that could be even a little bit more interesting than just somebody giving a prepared talk. You know,
yeah, they did do that in Barcelona. So at MicroConf in Barcelona, they had a panel on like customer acquisition and it was Rob and it was 3 of us or 4 of us on stage and we just went back and forth. So it was one question and then everyone kind of got their input and then gave feedback on what the other people were saying. And yeah, that was good. It can go sideways though, right? That's the tricky thing. You know, Rob's talk, the theme I got out of it was tactics have a half-life. Right. So that helped, let's just say, I don't know, webinars at some point were really, really big. And so that tactic doesn't work forever. And what it helped me think through was, keeping in mind the contrarian green light from Jason Fried. I have a bunch of things that we're trying to do on the marketing side that no one else is really doing. And Jason Fried's thinking, and then you combine it with Rob and that tactics have a half-life, it made it feel more okay for me to move forward with these marketing ideas because no one else is doing it. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Like maybe we're just ahead of the curve and we're at the front end of the half-life. Like this, you know, that application version of things and trying to limit the number of people that come in and positioning it as like high value because you have to apply to get in. Maybe that's a tactic that's early on and it's more okay for us to experiment with. It doesn't matter that no one else is doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, like what I always appreciate about Rob's talks or his perspective in general is how many different companies he sees, and he tends to analyze the commonalities and the patterns that he's seeing across literally hundreds of companies just like ours. Whereas like most of us are sort of focused on my company and what I can take and apply in my situation. He's always had this perspective of, you know, these are the things that have worked or have not worked in at different times. And that's always interesting to hear. He's in like sort of a unique vantage point that most people don't have. So it's very cool.
Yep. Yeah. And there was one moment, I don't know who it was in the audience that asked the question, but it was like my favorite moment of the actual conference. So Sahil from Gumroad gives his talk. Sahil from Gumroad goes out and raises like $7 million. And then it doesn't quite work out the way a VC wants the growth to happen. And then Sahil feels like a giant failure when in reality, he built this really nice, healthy business. And like that talk was about that transformation of like, oh, so what if it's not a billion-dollar company? It doesn't mean it's a failure. I actually like the company. I like my job, and so on. So you're in MicroConf. You're in that context where people are not default to VC. So Sahil goes through this whole talk. And then the very first question from the audience is effectively, so you raised a bunch of money, you killed all your competitors, and now you're sitting up on stage telling us the story. Like, basically, do you feel bad about that at all? And it came off as not, I don't know if rude is the word. It was a little confrontational, but it was the right question to ask. There's a retarding effect that venture capital has in a market when most of the other competitors don't raise money and you do. It's like it changes the market.
It was interesting, you know, how he basically, like he did have the benefits of the VC money to build up the company, and then had the benefit of not, basically got rid of that VC at no cost. There's a lot more to that story, of course, and although I don't fully buy that, like he necessarily killed all competitors, or that there was no space for competitors to jump in any of these years, you know. Like I don't think VC automatically kills all competition in a market, you know.
No, but it does have an effect. And it was just like, it was a little bit like hating, but it was the right question for that moment in that audience. And Sahil was like, you know, look, business is not fair. That's just the bottom line. You can do whatever you want. There are no rules that you have to play fair, and everyone has to have the same starting point. But it was an interesting moment.
Yeah. So we're home. We're back. Why don't we get into some updates on what's happening in CardHook and Process Kit and all the rest.
Cool. Sounds good. So I can start. Yesterday we had our first in-person event at the office. We had about 12 people here. So like 4 internally and 8 from outside the company. It all started with a tweet from one of our customers. It's actually a customer that also happens to be an investor, which I did not know for a long time. But then at some point I looked through the AngelList syndicate, like the 20 or so people that actually put money in, and I saw his name and was like, wait a minute, that's one of our customers. So it was a tweet by
him.
Wait,
so you knew that he was a customer, but you didn't know that he was an investor?
Yes.
That's funny.
AngelList syndicates are weird. Yep. So he just tweeted out, effectively just asking, like, anyone up for an e-commerce mastermind in Portland? So I tweeted back, we'll host. And that's where it started. And then we just invited a few other people and we just had people here. It was a great opportunity to basically learn about what people are thinking about. You know, it wasn't like a CardHook commercial. It wasn't all about us. We really just had a chance to, everyone did three people did presentations and we did a bunch of Q&A and then we just kind of talked about the market. It was fun. It was great.
Yeah, that's cool. And your team was like all there?
Not all, right? We didn't want to like take everyone's eye off the ball for an entire afternoon, yeah. But four of us were there for it.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, it was fun. Then we went out to dinner, and then I went out to see live music, which does not normally happen, and that's why I'm nursing a hangover right now.
Very cool. I'm hacking away every single day on Process Kit, making a lot of progress. I'm pretty psyched about it this week because today's Friday, and I'm just about, I won't say finished, but I did a lot of work this week on the process editor. So like basically a core functionality of Process Kit is being able to build out your processes and and create the steps and insert steps and move steps around and do all that kind of fun stuff. And I built out that user interface and functionality this week. That May 1st date of shipping it to customers, I'd say, I don't know. I think I'm like 50-50 on whether I'll actually have it ready that week to start inviting customers. We're, what are we, like 4 weeks, like less than 4 weeks away from that. There's a lot more that I need to build between now and then. So I think 50-50 is like, I feel pretty confident and that I'll have the product in some usable form by that week. But I think like 50-50 is like the best that I could that I could give myself, because there's so many things that can you know, push that back, of course. But I feel like I'm on track on it. I'm making a lot of progress every day on it. So that's pretty good. And then I'm just thinking about a bunch of other things to try and get in place. Like there's no way, you know, I'm a solo founder and I'm building the product myself. So there's really not a lot that I could do to have a full marketing engine kicking in by the time I'm shipping the product. The sad reality is that I'm just going to need to start doing like real marketing work, you know, in another month or two after the product is in better shape. And I have some ideas there. But what the one thing that I'm doing aside from actually working and building on the product is I'm making sure that I'm talking to customers at least two or three times a week. You know, I still have this, I'm still getting new people entering the early access list almost every day, and they fill out a survey and I always flag those, and I invite a handful of those every week to calls with me. And you know, those are sort of like interruptions. Those are extra calls on my calendar every week. If there's anything that is worth the disruption, it's talking to more customers, you know? And I think, you know, this is something that honestly not enough people do. I think a lot of us have come around to the idea of talking to customers early on during the validation phase, but I think it's better to continue that on a regular basis, even, and just have more and more conversations, because you start to peel a layer deeper and deeper as you go on. Like one thing that I learned this week, or that I sort of started to form a conclusion around this week, is who is really the ideal customer to go after for Process Kit in terms of team size. You know, so we talked about how I'm planning on I'm gonna be pricing per user, and there's gonna be a base plan of probably around $50 a month that includes up to three users, and then somewhere around $20 a month per user after that. I'm speaking to people in all different team sizes, and they roughly fall into three groups. One group is like under five people. They're probably like one to three people, maybe an extra contractor here and there. And then I'm speaking to a lot of people in that like 5 to 15 person range, which is like a mix of full-time and some contractors. And then I speak to a bunch of people who are like 20, 25 plus teams, right? Obviously, the larger the team, the more value the customer is. It would be great to get a lot of those large teams on board on Process Kit. But one thing that I sort of learned in these conversations is that if you're at a team of like 25, like I spoke to a guy the other day who was like 30, 35 people on his team. At that stage, they're already very invested in a tool or a couple of tools that run their system. And they already have very mature systems and processes to have a team of operating at that level and growing, you know? So like Process Kit does fit their use case perfectly in many ways. But what I'm learning is that it would be a very, very uphill, like a hard challenge to get a team like that to switch at that stage.
Yeah, fair enough.
So what I'm learning is that in that 5 to 15 person range, things are more in flux. Like their team is starting to grow, and things are starting to grow more rapidly at that size, and they have begun processes. They're starting to feel the pain of trying to manage their process and their team, and at that stage they're more likely to be trying out different tools or more open to switching tools. So that's sort of like the ideal point to catch them at, and then over time they can expand into that larger company using Process Kit. You know, the smaller teams, I think the base plan would fit some of those people. But a lot of them, like if you're just solo and you don't really have employees, it's just probably not a good fit. And I'm just not going to really target those people. But if I could target companies that are starting to grow, they're around 10 to 15 employees and they're seeing some growth, like that's sort of the right point to catch them at, I think.
I think you're doing the right thing in talking to customers throughout development, because it's really, really easy to confirm your assumptions and then go into the bunker and build and come out like, okay, cool. Now I have the product that everyone told me that they wanted, even though it's been, 3 to 6 months since I really was talking to customers all the time.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about these customer calls is I think too many people focus too heavily on talking about features. I talk about features too, but like, there's this tendency to either do one of two things, which is like, let's discover and you tell me what features to build, what features will magically come out of this conversation, or, hey, I want to build these features. Do you like that? Do you think that's interesting? Like, and then it's like, yes or no. And like, both of those don't really do you a lot of good, I don't think. In my experience, like they help in helping me like prioritize like which features in this product vision should come to the top. But in these customer calls, I think it's more important to understand like their world, like what's happening in your world right now, especially if they're resonating with the product, like if they're expressing like interest in not only the features, but like when is it going to be ready? Like I'm ready to buy it now, or I just purchased this other competing product. Like we're actively searching for a solution for this. If I'm hearing things like that, then what I want to understand is, well, what's happening in your world right now that's actually motivating you to go out and look for a tool or go out and even trial some competitor in the last few months, And that's where the insight came from of figuring out like, well, if you're in this like 10 person range, you're more likely to be looking for tools. Whereas if you're in this like 25, 30 plus team member range, you're like, you see this as a big distraction. Like you might be sort of like interested in what ProcessKit might be able to do, but then I just flat out asked him, I'm like, even if it fits your needs and the price is right, what would it take for you to switch? And that's where teams at that size start to feel some resistance of like,
oh, yes.
Oh, that's going to be just a big effort,
Yep. Yeah. So I can confirm that from our experience. When we got in that 5 to 10 person range, all the tools that we were using weren't good enough. So that's when we went hunting, right? Just what do we need? And each person that was running each department basically came to us and said, okay, so this is not good enough for support. Let's move to Front. And that's when we get on a system like Front, and then everyone uses it. And to get off of it, there's a lot of reluctance, man. It messes up everyone's workflow. So I think you're right. And even more so with your product, because your product is very central to business processes. So you have to understand what they're dealing with. If you don't get that right, then you're gonna make a bunch of wrong assumptions on who the right people are for the product.
Yeah, and the product is literally designed to run their operations with their team. And so I think it's both a big challenge, but also a big asset for this type of product. Like the challenge is getting teams to adopt it, and that's why I think slightly smaller teams are more likely to go over that hurdle. But the asset is that once your team is locked in, it's essential to your operation, and it's like a big disruption to get rid of it. So
right, then the reluctance works in your favor.
Yeah, yep.
Cool, man.
So how about you? What's up?
So I want to talk about pricing again, and I just want to talk through about how we're thinking about pricing tiers and what should go into each. But I do have some fun milestones. We hit 20 people, which is crazy. So now number 19 started on Monday, and then number 20 starts in 2 weeks, I believe. So it's officially 20 people, which is...
Is that total across the two offices?
Yes, that's right. Yep. And then I think we'll hire somewhere in like the three or four more people over the next few weeks. So yes, a new period of growth on the employee side. And we're going to do our best to do a better job of onboarding and like effectively indoctrinating people into here's what we're doing and why, here are our customers, here's the origin story of the company, here's the what you need to know, here's a warm welcome, here's company swag. We just want to do a much better job with this new wave of hires than we have in the past.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, I mean, maybe this is for another show, but I'd like to hear like how your new employee onboarding process looks. Like I'm having these conversations with people and that's one of the two most common processes that people need to figure out is okay. Employee onboarding. And then the other one is like new customer onboarding. But yeah, how do you deal with employees?
Okay. Well, we actually have a meeting coming up next week to focus on that. So by next week, I'll be able to talk more specifically about what we're doing. We kind of did a lot of this like culture inward focus stuff about a month or two ago. And then have just been heads down for the past month and kind of like let it go by the wayside. And now with this new batch of hires coming in, we're like refocused on it.
Cool. So we'll come back to that.
Yeah. And then the other milestone we hit is we crossed $500 million total processed revenue. Half a B, baby. So hopefully the next half of a B is a lot faster than the first. Right. That goes along with what we've talked about, I think, in the last episode, where we're looking much more at customer KPIs. It's working. That new way to look at KPIs. So last month in March, we hit our holiday level of processed revenue. Right. So our highest month ever was November. We processed 46 million. And then last month we hit 43 million. So it's like it took 3 months to go from holiday high to then the dip in January. And now we're right back at our highest peak just 3 months later. Yeah. And it's like
that. And this is like a non-holiday normal time to be hitting.
Yes. Right. And so that we see that's progress. And then you look at the MRR and it's right behind it. It's like, okay, so that's right. That's the right leading indicator. The process revenue, how companies are doing on an individual basis, what percentage of their upsells are being taken, and so on. Okay, so those are the two cool milestones. And we've focused a lot on pricing lately. And there was a tweet by Josh Ledgard. He's the founder of Kickoff Labs. So I don't know what the conversation was really about. I think it was revenue growth or plateaus or something. But what he added in, it's very simple. I think – I don't remember the exact wording, but he said, we really started to grow the most when we started to prioritize features that grew revenue. And I read that and I was like, why don't I think of it that way? I don't understand. Like why is that the first time I'm hearing that idea? Right? Because we look at our features and the priority list and a lot of it is based on like how loud are customers yelling for this thing. Whereas imagine thinking about it the other way, like which feature is going to allow us to charge more? That's what he said. He goes, when we focused on features that allowed us to charge more. So I took that and brought it internally. I'm like, okay, guys, I have something to admit. I've never thought of it this way before, even though it's very obvious that we should be thinking about this, at least to an extent. And then we start to look at our priorities and our roadmap, and we're looking at things that are like, you know, P3. Right. So we call P1, P2, and P3 and so on. It's like priority one, priority two, like different waves, basically what's set for sprints into the future. So we would look at things on like P3 that's, you know, months away that we could charge more for because it's really valuable. So we started shifting those around. And then what we put it together with our pricing conversations and we said, oh shit, what we're doing here is we're building a higher tier. So what features do we want to add that are so valuable that we can break it out into a separate tier because they're so valuable that we should demand people pay more for them? It's like almost embarrassing. Like, well, why? Of course you should think about it that way. But it's in the day to day, a lot of it is reacting to the vision of the product and the demands of the customers.
Yeah. And I guess another way to look at it too, could be like maybe it's a feature that you could charge more, put it into a higher tier, or it could even be or it could be like a feature that helps replace a different tool that they're also paying for, which can lead to, you know, just more signups or you know, more getting over the hump during onboarding or converting, you know.
Right. I think we were in the mindset of, okay, we want to change our pricing. Also known as raise prices, right? We haven't changed our pricing in 2 years. We know for sure that it's not optimal. We know and feel that having more than one tier is right for us. And we were looking at it like we were kind of trying to come up with like excuses, like, okay, what can we charge for? Like different support response times? We were kind of at a loss, like, all right, we know we want to separate these out, but what's actually valuable? And then when that tweet about features, it seems obvious in hindsight, but then we just started looking down the roadmap into the future and pulling out features that that are charge worthy. And that helped us very easily identify, oh, that's what goes into a different tier. So A/B testing, you got to pay more for that because it makes you more money. It's more valuable. Yep. So that was a fun and really exciting thing because now everyone's super pumped because they know building these features leads directly to more revenue. And that gets everyone excited.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So here's a quick one. Something on my mind. Like I said, I'm not really doing any real work on setting up the marketing plan for Process Kit. But one thing that's on my mind is like I am going to need to design a legit marketing site for it. Like right now, I just have the one landing page with sort of like a manifesto on it. Asks for an email address. It has like no images whatsoever or anything like that. It's just here's Process Kit. You might like it. Enter your email address. That's all I have. So at some point, I need to design a real marketing site, and I would like this thing to get done sometime around May or June. You know, usually I design it and write all the copy myself. I think this time I am going to hire a designer. I'm going to look for someone really great to do the design, the look and the feel of the front end homepage branding, you know, style guide of it. So I'm thinking through like how I'm going to approach that because you know I am used to just sort of doing it myself. So it's really like I want to find a really great designer to sort of like collaborate with on it. The main reason I want to do it that way is number one is just time. I'm focused on the product and selling to customers and other stuff. So
it is a lot of work.
Yeah, but I think more so I just really want the marketing site to be amazing. And I don't consider myself that great of a visual designer. My other sites, you know, like for audience ops and stuff, like I did those and I think I can do a decent job of like, you know, communicating some information somewhat clearly on the page. But, you know, when I look at some of these just really well-known SaaS marketing sites, just to have it really shine, really stand out and just kind of, you know, wow people when they get to the page, that's sort of what I'm going for. And I'd like to find someone who can really, really help me with that.
I'm proud of you. I wish you luck in being able to control yourself in that environment. I wish the designer all the luck in the world. And I'm looking forward to hear how you go through the process. Marketing site envy is real. Everyone wants a beautiful site. It's really hard to nail, and it's expensive, or it can be really expensive.
Yeah, like this is one area where I'm planning to spend some money. You know, because I'm saving a lot by building the product myself, and I have some sort of cash savings that I've been building up to invest in something, and I could take a chunk of that and throw it at this because I think it's really important. You know, I think especially because I'll be launching this into a pretty competitive market, like it has to be a really and I want to establish like a brand and style guide that I could use for at least a year or more. You know. For all different stuff. I've worked with designers and other people before, but I am so used to designing it myself. So I need to try to figure out what is the right process for like, do I do some rough layouts and like, how do I communicate my goals for this thing and that kind of stuff? And what should I actually ask for from a designer? Like, do I just need like a homepage mockup or do I need a style guide or some combination of that? Like, if any listeners know someone or you are this person, like I'm looking for someone who's really experienced in designing SaaS marketing websites. You know, there's a lot of really great designers who kind of focus on different types of sites, but you know, I'm gonna like ask around of SaaS sites that I really like and ask who designed it. So.
Yeah, the hard part is that it's not just the design. You have to get the conversion and the marketing and the copy and the messaging right. So I'll be curious to see what your process looks like. Maybe you inject your marketing expertise first.
Yeah, well, that's usually how I go about it anyway. When I do the whole thing myself. So on the copywriting side, like I almost always start by just writing the copy, like in a Google Doc, before I even design the page, and then I go to some sort of wireframes or start designing in the browser based off of the copy that I've already written. I am gonna do like a first pass at the copy, like the headline and the main points and the benefits and sort of how the message that I want to communicate. But I think I'm also going to look to hire a really great copywriter to do a second pass after my first pass and, you know, punch it up, make it more interesting, make it funnier, make it whatever, to just really hit home. So I'm thinking about hiring a designer and a copywriter, the copywriter probably for a smaller project to do like a revision on my first draft, you know?
Yeah. Makes sense. You may want to get some feedback and learn more stuff first for just being in the market for a month or two and then go through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. We meant to do that about 6 months ago, but it didn't work out. Yes. Not yet anyway. Right. Cool, man. And the last thing for me is I hired an assistant. So I'm
going to I want to hear about that.
I mean, I'm very excited. They started this week and, you know, we're kind of learning how to work together. I use Todoist as my to-do app and we have a shared list and I'm just starting to add things to her list instead of mine. All right.
I have questions. Sure. So assistant, like, is this an assistant for you within Cardhook or is it like a personal assistant, like in your life?
So what I needed was both, right? I need both. A lot of my stress comes from not being able to get things done on the personal side. And then at the same time, I have a bunch of stuff that I could really use a lot of help with on the business side. So it took me some time to kind of get over it, right? I felt a little guilty. I said, you know, should the company really be paying for an assistant that helps me with like my travel to Michigan when we go away? And really what I came to the conclusion was, the company wants to pay me for that. If I turned it around and an employee came to me and said, look, it would really help me if the company could get me this type of software and it would help me or whatever. I guess it's not perfectly related to the personal life, but I would want to use money in that way to free up people's time.
Yeah, and frees up your time and focus. Yes. To focus on the company.
Yes. So I just kind of got over it and now I'm okay with the blend. So I needed both. And this company that I'm working with, Worldwide 101, I saw a tweet by Marshall Haas where he wrote a blog post about how he uses his assistant and how they work together and like what's been good and bad about it. And he works with Worldwide 101. I went to the site and checked it out and saw someone I recognized, Drew Sinaki, do like a testimonial video for them. And that was enough for me. I got in touch with them. They interviewed me. They then made a recommendation and then I met the person they recommended. And I decided, yes, I want to move forward with it. And so
the person is local to you in person?
No. She's in North Carolina, I believe.
Okay.
We're just starting out with 20 hours a month. And my goal, I'll see success as moving up to the next year to 40 hours a month, because that'll mean I'm actually using it properly.
Got it. So things like booking travel, like what else are you tasking her with?
Sure. So I can just pull up the list and I can start to like, you know, I have Todoist. That's what I use for my to-do app. And I have way too many tasks listed here. And so really what I'm doing is going through my list and just deciding, should I really be doing this or can a perfectly capable, smart human being handle this other than me? Right. That's what it is. It's not, and I'm happy to pay up. It's relatively expensive, but the people are really good. They're perfectly capable, smart people that have a lot of experience. So it's like there's no, this is too complex, so I guess I have to do it myself. Like, no, this person's just as capable. So that was important for me also. So like one funny thing on the personal side is I want to cancel certain things. So like ButcherBox, I don't want to do it anymore. I just haven't gone in and canceled it. So I'm trying to figure out ways to do things that I normally wouldn't do, or I'm too lazy, or have some weird block. Like it takes 60 seconds to log into the ButcherBox and cancel it, but I just haven't done it. So anything from that to I lost my credit card you know how much time it takes to go through your personal credit card and identify everything that you have connected to it, and then go get a new card and then go out and switch all those accounts? Like, that's, it's hours, and I should not be doing that. So that's another example.
How do you, so the other thing that I'm wondering at is how much of this stuff, like when you delegate those tasks to her, does it create more work for you to give her what she needs in order to be able to do it? So like you got to get her all access to all your different logins, like probably through 1Password or whatever you're using, I guess. How much extra instructions do you get, or do you hand something off and like she just has questions for you, and maybe that's an easier way of doing it, is like ask whatever questions you need and I'll answer them? But
that's the part that I've always been up in the air about, like, oh, now this is like a new thing for me to do and be responsible for. And that blog post by Marshall, that was where he got me, right? That's where the value I got out of that post was, here's the deal. If you don't hand over all of your information, you're not going to get the value out of it. And that's what I did in the past. I was like, this is weird for me to give all my banking and credit card information, but you won't get the same value. So I'm going to try to do my best to not create more work for me. And one of the good things about Todoist is you can have a little conversation along with each to-do. And so when I just write back, like, call the Hartford fund and see if what this insurance bill is, right? I got an insurance bill for the business, and it's like I don't have an employee in the state of New York anymore, and I'm just not sure if this insurance was just related to that. That's kind of my hunch. And so I don't want to call them. But someone else can definitely call them and say, hey, what's this about? Is it just for a New York employee? If so, we can cancel it and we're not going to pay this bill. And someone just will do that for me. And that's like a business responsibility that takes half an hour that I just don't want to do.
It's those things that kill me, is when like I got to like call up, I don't know, like state of Connecticut or something, or like I get some notice in the mail that like doesn't make any sense. And I got to wait on hold for an hour on a Tuesday because they're only open during the week. Like that kind of stuff just absolutely drives me up the wall.
Yes. And so there are things like that you currently have on your list that I want to remove from my list. And what I'm along with moving up into more hours, another sign of success will be on executing on ideas that I would never even put on my to-do list because I just dismiss.
Right. Right. So like, it's like, so like business things or even like marketing things that like it, or it's just.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of our pieces of thinking is that we should be going after direct-to-consumer companies that have raised money. And so going out and gathering that information takes time, but we want to do it. So I want to know direct-to-consumer companies that have raised money, who they raised money from, how much money they raised, who the right people are to contact. And that background work, I just won't do. I just don't have the time to do that. But to spend 3 or 4 hours on that is valuable work. Then we can reach out to 50 funded D2C companies and see if maybe they'd be interested in our service.
My hesitation has always been in terms of like getting a personal assistant to do random miscellaneous work. Like I have a lot of people on my team who have very defined roles. They've got processes that they're just always executing week in, week out. So I don't need to, it doesn't create more work for me to keep them busy because they already have these processes going. But I've always had trouble finding that like assistant or someone to be a generalist to do a bunch of different stuff. Cause in the past, it has created more work for me to do like a brain dump and give them all my stuff, not just give them access, but give them like my knowledge that they're going to need to do it. But I guess the way to get over that is like, you don't need to even do that. You don't need to give them all of your history, you know, background knowledge. Like let them use some of their hours to do their own research and figure it out, and they'll probably figure out a better way to do it than you know it, you know.
That's right. And the more, my goal is to have this person integrated into my life. When things come up, they have gotten to know us over time. They've gotten to know the airlines we like to fly. They've gotten to know my thinking on things, and we can just kind of start to work together better over time. And I'm really hoping it works out, but I'll keep you updated.
Very cool. Yeah, the only other real quick one was that we're looking for a more technical writer at Audience Ops. We have a couple, but they're kind of full. So we need somebody who can write more confidently about, you know, code, technology, SaaS, WordPress, design, development, UI, UX, stuff like that. We have a few people that we're interviewing right now, and we're probably going to bring one or two of them on, but we are still open for applications. And one thing that I did yesterday on that was we have a page that we give to applicants who've been hand-selected and invited to interviews. We first show them a page that gives them more information about what it's like to work at Audience Ops and some information about the pay rate and stuff like that. So I went through and I actually rewrote that page. It's been about like two or three years since I wrote it. And because I wanted to like sell the position more. I wanted to, because it is a very different sort of working experience. So like, I think if you're a freelancer, you just immediately look at the rate per word or whatever, or per article or whatever it is. And they either say, yes, that works, or no, like, I don't even want, like, I can't even take it because other ones pay me more or whatever. So I want to get across, like, these are all the benefits that come with working at Audience Ops. And this is what writers here make on average every month in total, you know, like it's several thousand dollars. And like, when I put it in those terms, it gives a fuller picture because it is a different type of position. For years, I've had this outlook of like, I'm trying to sell the position of working at Audience Ops just as much as I'm selling to customers of buying Audience Ops, you know, like buying the service. So like, I think that's a tip for most people is to like, you know, make the position as attractive as possible and sell what's unique about it, you know? So that's something that I've been thinking about this week a bit.
That turns into one of the most critical jobs. When someone comes in for an interview that we want to hire, you are selling the company, but you have to give a very realistic expectation at the same time, right? That's the tricky part is you don't want someone to come in and have a surprise. So we interviewed someone like a PhD in chemistry, and she's interested in the product manager role. But I need this person to understand everything about the company and what they're getting into and all of our risks and the upside. And then you kind of get into the fact that we've talked about levers before. Like, this is not going to be the highest paying job you can get, but here's what you're going to get out of it beyond the money. And if that's right for you, then come on in.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's part of what I put in there was like, look, like, these are all the things that as a freelancer, you're normally doing all this stuff yourself, like the sales and the proposals and the invoicing and the client communication and copy editing. And those are all things that you don't do at Audience Ops. Like, that stuff is done for you. All you get to do is come up and research your own topics, and then you get to write those topics, and that's it. And then you hand it off to someone else to take care of posting to WordPress and all the other, you know, legwork. That's all handled. And, you know, plus you've got a team around here. We've got amazing managers who make it easy. And so I'm trying to like sell all that because like that is not always obvious to a freelancer who's sort of evaluating like 100 different potential gigs every month, and you know, trying to express that like our team, a lot of them are freelancers, but they've been here for like 3+ years, and a lot of them are like stay-at-home parents, and it's very flexible and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, and I think it's helping. I think people are responding to it a little bit, you know, a little bit better.
Good, man. I hope you find them. Maybe they're listening.
Yeah, hope so. That'd be good.
Cool. All right, I have propped myself up long enough. I'm going to go get horizontal and be honest with myself and my hangover.
Good call. All right, buddy.
Good talk, man.
All right, later.
Thanks, everybody.